This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with John Burroughs about the new nuclear posture review. What kind of danger are we in?
Terrible danger. I don't mean to be melodramatic, but it really is a danger for all of humanity. Give a listen to this.
And we'll talk with author Miko Peled about his new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5.
Due process, that is fairness, and our very constitutional rights are being undermined by the overreaching on the war on terrorism. Five men who did nothing or sacrificed, some of them doing 65 years in prison for this.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Not since 1953, when the United States and the Soviet Union exploded thermonuclear bombs, has the world been such a powder keg. Last week, the Pentagon released its Nuclear Posture Review. It seeks to make U.S. use of nuclear weapons more acceptable and plausible. It recommends the spending of $1 trillion to upgrade America's nuclear arsenal, and it appears to end the U.S. commitment to pursue nuclear disarmament. Last November, Senator Bob Corker, a Republican from Tennessee, convened a hearing of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the limits of presidential authority to use nuclear weapons. President Trump had been making incendiary comments about North Korea, threatening to, quote, totally destroy the country and to unleash, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen. There are no reliable limits on the president's power to order use of nuclear weapons. The International Court of Justice declared in 1996 that the use of threat of use of nuclear weapons is illegal under international law. The United States is not legally bound by the ICJ opinion. Moreover, the UN last summer adopted a, quote, treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. It states that the use of nuclear weapons would be, quote, against the principles of humanity in the dictates of public conscience. The United States is not legally bound by the new UN treaty either. This country, under President Obama and now Trump, has vowed, in fact, to increase the size of America's nuclear arsenal. And this country will not agree to simply declare that it is opposed to the first use of nuclear weapons. We speak today with attorney John Burroughs, executive director of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms. John, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be here.
The Nuclear Posture Review seeks to make the U.S. use of nuclear weapons more acceptable and plausible. How does it do so?
Right. The Nuclear Posture Review was released last week by the Trump administration. The last time one was done was during the Obama administration in 2010. And the major difference as far as doctrine is this. The Trump Nuclear Posture Review says that the U.S. might use nuclear weapons in response to strategic non-nuclear attacks. And elsewhere in the document, it indicates that strategic non-nuclear attacks could include biological attacks, chemical attacks, or cyber attacks. So the expert commentary on this has emphasized the fact that this is the first time there's been a signal from the United States government that nuclear weapons could be used in response to a cyber attack.
And thus, would you suggest this exacerbates nuclear dangers?
Well, absolutely. It at least on paper, it lowers the threshold for use of nuclear weapons. In cyber attacks are of special concern because, let's say you have a breakdown of a major civilian system, like the supply of electricity. Well, first of all, do you really know that it's a cyber attack that caused it? But secondly, if you know it's a cyber attack, who did the cyber attack. Even if the U.S. is in a war somewhere, you don't necessarily know that the country you're fighting somewhere is the one who caused the cyber attack. So it introduces a lot, a wider range of contingencies. And it's important to remember that the U.S., from the beginning of the nuclear age, has set the model. As the U.N. Secretary General once said, doctrines of deterrence are contagious. So once the U.S. adopts a doctrine, it will tend to spread to the other nuclear powers. And then you have a situation where governments are saying, well, if we think we've been subjected to a very serious cyber attack, we might resort to nuclear weapons. So the risks grow. But, you know, aside from the question of cyber attack, the overall thrust of the Trump nuclear posture review is we are ready to use nuclear weapons in a fairly wide range of situations. There's not, in the Obama nuclear posture review, there was a pretty strong reluctance signaled regarding use of nuclear weapons. It wasn't ruled out, but it was sort of signaled that it would have to be an extremely unusual situation where we would consider it.
John, in addition to a cyber attack possibly triggering, what other circumstances, can you give us an example or two, might trigger a nuclear response?
Well, here's something that's particularly concerning in the Trump nuclear posture review. You know, there's a certain kind of expert, nuclear insider. They love to engage in theory about how so-called nuclear deterrence is supposed to work. So one of their theories is that, let's say Russia was engaged in a war with European countries in the United States, somewhere near the Russian border. And then Russia, in this scenario, would use a low-yield weapon to try to bring the conflict to an end. It's like, this conflict must stop because the risks of escalation are too great. So in this theoretical view of, you know, some U.S. insiders, the U.S. would need to have a very specific nuclear response to that. Therefore, they are proposing that a low-yield warhead be put on submarine-based missiles to be able to respond to such a scenario. Well, I think you can see what I mean about this being extremely theoretical and even fanciful, but that it's right there in the nuclear posture review.
It's plenty scary. I mean, for one thing, I think one of the things that has driven this whole nuclear escalation has been the military-industrial complex, the nuclear weapons makers as part of that complex. And they're willing to spend over $1 trillion to do this, and they're blaming Russia for starting it. And I wanted to ask you this, John. Would you conclude that the nuclear posture review ends the U.S. commitment to pursue nuclear disarmament?
Yeah. You know, Michael, first of all, let me say that the Trump administration inherited an unaffordable plan from the Obama administration. As you say, over $1 trillion over a 30-year period to recapitalize, modernize, replace the submarine-based, the land-based U.S. nuclear forces, talking about the missiles, and also the bombers and the air-launched cruise missiles. Already a plan in place to replace all of that. And, you know, not necessary for purposes of so-called deterrence. Now the Trump administration is adding some bells and whistles. They want this low-yield warhead, and they want a sea-launched cruise missile. So when this gets into the congressional budgetary process, Congress needs to insert some rationality into this and say, this is just absurd. You know, the United States has much more important things to spend money on than this kind of incredible remaking and addition to U.S. nuclear forces. Now, shall I say something about the disarmament obligation?
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Heidi was just about to ask you about that.
Yeah, well, so the U.S. Has a treaty obligation under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, to which, you know, most countries in the world are party, to pursue negotiations on effective measures relating to cessation of the nuclear arms race and nuclear disarmament. And that's a treaty obligation in the United States, no question about it. And it's been reinforced in NPT meetings, and so, for example, at one NPT review conference, it was agreed, including by the United States, that there is an unequivocal undertaking under this obligation to eliminate nuclear arsenals. And the International Court of Justice, in the 1996 advisory opinion, also said unanimously that this obligation means that all countries, but especially those with nuclear weapons, are obligated to pursue in good faith and bring to a conclusion, succeed in eliminating nuclear weapons. Now, the 2010 Obama Nuclear Posture Review referred to the Nonproliferation Treaty obligation, and it devoted a lot of attention to this kind of long-term plan to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons. And I hope some people remember that Obama gave a speech in Prague in 2009 laying out sort of a vision of a world free of nuclear weapons. None of this is in the Trump NPR. The obligation to negotiate nuclear disarmament is not referred to, and arms control measures like agreements with Russia are referred to as possibilities only if they contribute to stabilization of the relationship. There's nothing about proceeding towards nuclear disarmament. So a big change.
John, speaking of changes, a group of distinguished scientists, as you know, work with the magazine The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. The magazine has a doomsday clock on the front cover, and last week the editors advanced that clock, the hands of the clock, to 2 minutes to midnight. What was the scientist's assessment to move the clock hand based on?
First of all, they are concerned that progress on averting climate change is minimal, and the Trump administration has said that the U.S. is withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement. So that was one element of it. But the lead element was just the sort of thing we've been talking about. The U.S. is engaged in a confrontation with North Korea, which has a rapidly advancing nuclear and missile program. And a lot of people say, and I would say, that the chances of use of nuclear weapons are higher than they have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis because of the confrontation with North Korea. And then, in general, progress on arms control and disarmament has been more or less non-existent in the last decade. So that's why the clock hands were moved.
Trump asked his chief of staff, and this is the question, it's a quote, "If we have nuclear weapons, why don't we use them?" If you were the chief of staff, what would have been your reply?
Right. I believe, Michael, this was something that was said during the campaign season. And my answer would be, you can't cannot use nuclear weapons, that even in response to another state's use of nuclear weapons, because the risks of escalation are too great, up to and including, if we're talking U.S.-Russia, we're actually talking about the possible end of human civilization. Apocalypse is not a fantasy in that sort of scenario. And, you know, some people might think, oh, well, this is just kind of some peacenik lawyer saying this. Well, it is reported that this was the advice that Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara gave to President Kennedy. Very, very private advice. But he told Kennedy, you need to decide now, not during a crisis, what your attitude will be about use of nuclear weapons. And my advice to you, McNamara's advice to Kennedy, is that you decide you will never use nuclear weapons under any circumstance.
John, are current atomic weapons more powerful than the ones used by the USA in the bombing of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Yes. Those bombs were on the order of 15 to 20 kilotons. And when you hear a discussion, like in the Nuclear Posture Review, of low-yield nuclear weapons, they're talking about weapons that are, say, 5 kilotons, 1 kiloton, but most bombs in the U.S. arsenal and the arsenal of other nuclear powers are on the order of 10 times the size of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. So, you know, 200 kilotons instead of 20 kilotons. And in the past, the size of nuclear weapons has gotten up into the megaton range, meaning, 100 times larger. And the U.S. Still has one bomb in its arsenal that's in the megaton range.
We've been speaking with John Burroughs, who is the head of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms.
If Donald Trump decided he was going to press a button and use a nuclear weapon, can he be stopped? And I recall reading months ago about how members of the intelligence community don't necessarily tell the president everything, and it was insinuated that there might be a human backup plan. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, well, there was an extremely interesting public discussion of these matters that took place last fall. There was a hearing before the Senate, I think it was the Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by Senator Corker, and there was a former commander of Strategic Command by the name of Robert Keller. And Strategic Command is the Pentagon entity that controls all nuclear weapons. And so Keller said that the military would refuse. He was, basically talking about at the top levels, not so much as commands go down through the system, but at the top levels, they would refuse in order to use nuclear weapons that did not meet the requirements of the law of armed conflict. And, you know, the law of armed conflict says that military operations must be necessary, they must be proportionate, and they must meet requirements of discrimination between military targets and civilians and civilian infrastructure. Now, in the course of this conversation, both at the hearing and then in subsequent commentary, it's a little bit confusing exactly how it works. But, you know, it appears that if you know, there was an impending nuclear attack on the United States, like missiles are on their way or a nuclear explosion has already occurred, that there are existing plans in place, and if the president ordered a responsive use of nuclear weapons, it would probably just happen pretty quickly. But if the U.S. was in a situation where the use of nuclear weapons was being considered like a first use of nuclear weapons, say in the Korean context, not in response to a nuclear attack, that there then would be a fairly serious discussion within the executive branch. And, you know, military commanders could say, well, it's not necessary, or it doesn't meet the requirements of the law of armed conflict, and, you know, try to persuade the president to do something different. Well, in the end, under existing procedures, the president makes the final decision. And so whether there would be a military refusal to follow a presidential order in that circumstance is uncertain, highly uncertain, but at least it's a possibility. So that's sort of the picture that was drawn of this. Meanwhile, what about Congress? Does Congress not have a role in any of this? And so there are several bills proposed in Congress that some of them, first of all, would just say, look, you know, if there's going to be a war in general with North Korea, it must be approved by Congress. That just follows from the U.S. Constitution, which says that it's the power of Congress to declare war. But Markey and other senators have also been saying, you know, the use of nuclear weapons, especially the first use of nuclear weapons by the United States, is comparably important, and there should also be a legislative requirement for congressional approval of the first use of nuclear weapons. So it was really an incredible discussion that took place last fall, and it would seem that it's partly because there's a lot of concern or anxiety about this particular man, Donald Trump, having the powers that U.S. presidents have always had with respect to nuclear weapons.
John, remind us, if you will, what the actual process looks like when the president and hopefully Congress make a decision to launch a nuclear weapon. Do they go to a certain room? He has his briefcase. How does that work?
The shorter answer is I don't know. You know, there are various reports about how this would work. For instance, Bruce Blair is now a scholar at Princeton, has written a lot about it. But, you know, it's pretty classified, really. But, you know, it would seem that the president gets information about a military situation and then hopefully does consultations within the executive branch. But if a decision is made, that's something that the president just passes down the chain of command, and ordinarily it would just be executed.
And if listeners are appropriately frightened right now after listening to this interview, what can they do, John?
Right. Well, one thing I've already mentioned is the spending that is called for in the Nuclear Posture Review obviously is going to have to be done by Congress. So that's a point of an arena of intervention. Another thing is that Senators Markey and Feinstein wrote a letter strongly criticizing the Nuclear Posture Review when it was about to be released. And it was signed by senators, including Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Cory Booker. In other words, it was signed by senators who are mentioned as possible presidential candidates. So I think that what we need to do is to inject these issues about nuclear weapons, which are, you know, in the end, they're issues about the future of the human species, to inject them into the elections this coming year in 2018, but then also in the 2020 elections where the presidency will be up for grabs.
John, how can our listeners learn more about the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms?
Right. I am the executive director of Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, which is the UN office of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms. And the website for my organization is LCNP.org, Lawyers Committee Nuclear Policy, LCNP.org. And the website for the international organization is IALANA.org, IALANA.org.
John, as usual, this has been a really lucid and sobering interview.
Well, thank you. I wish we didn't have to discuss these things.
We need to get this out there.
It's plenty scary with an obviously disturbed person like Trump with his hand on his big button. Yesterday it was reported that he wants to have a military parade of tanks and missiles in Washington, D.C. I mean, this whole thing is escalating. Rather than having nuclear disarmament as a goal, the opposite is happening. And everybody that listens to this program should do what John suggested, lobby like hell to get people in Congress to oppose the spending of more than $1 trillion on a nuclear arms race that could only result in the destruction of humanity. John, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Cause I'm a conscious Rastaman, treading on the land.
In 2004, federal agents raided the homes of five Palestinian American families, arresting the five dads. The first trial of the Holy Land Foundation Five ended in a hung jury. The second, marked by highly questionable procedures, resulted in very lengthy sentences for, quote, supporting terrorism by donating to the charities with whom the United States government itself and several respected international agencies had long worked. Capitalizing on post-9/11 Islamophobic hysteria, the U.S. government used secret evidence and conflated charity with terrorism to convict the five men of providing material support for terrorism. The destruction of the Holy Land Foundation, the largest Muslim charity in the United States, constitutes one of the great judicial injustices in the war on terrorism, of which there have been many. The U.S. government, relying on the testimony of anonymous Israeli security experts, convicted the five men of the crime of providing humanitarian aid to Palestinians suffering under an illegal and punishing occupation. This case is one of several repressive post-9/11 U.S. prosecutions that have been brought with the assistance of Israeli security police targeting U.S. Palestinian Muslim activists. We speak today with human rights activist and author Miko Peled, who wrote the just-released book Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Five Foundation. As Chris Hedges has written, this book is an ominous and important warning about the degradation of the rule of law and civil liberties that increasingly characterizes American society. Miko Peled was born and raised in Jerusalem. He's the author of the acclaimed memoir The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Peled was born into a prominent Zionist family. He has emerged as a strong and outspoken advocate of justice and equality in Palestine.
Miko, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Tell our listeners, if you will, a bit about your background and how you got involved in the case of the Holy Land Five.
My background is that I was born in Jerusalem to a family, a patriotic Zionist Israeli family. That story is all related in my book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. I've been involved in activism for the cause of justice and equality and freedom in Palestine for a long time now. My first meeting with the Holy Land was just before The General's Son came out. In the fall of 2011, I was in Dallas giving a talk, and the organizers of my talk were among the organizers of my talk were daughters of some of these five men, the Holy Land Five. And they told me the story, which sounded pretty unbelievable. And then there was a gentleman in the audience who was very much involved with the case, and he came up to me and suggested, he said, if I was interested, he can send me more information, which he did. And then I went ahead and met with the families and got more and more involved until I decided I wanted to write this book. But what was interesting is, or one of the things that drove me to make this decision, I shared the story with people around me, you know, just normal people, Americans, you know, people you work with, people you meet, and nobody believed it. Nobody believed that such an injustice could have taken place here in America. Nobody understands that America has political prisoners, that political prisoners is an issue in America. That, to me, was a good enough reason to sit down and prove and just to show that this case exists, that this reality exists. So it was a strong motivation for me to write this book.
Miko, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the case, what exactly was the Holy Land Foundation, and why was it shut down by the Bush administration?
The Holy Land Foundation, or the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development, as it's known fully, was the largest Muslim charity in America. And they were involved in charity mostly for Palestine, but not only. They were involved in charity all over the U.S. They were among the responders after 9/11. They were responders after the Oklahoma City bombing. They responded to floods and earthquakes in the U.S. and around the world. They did incredible work all over, but again, focusing mainly on Palestine and the needs of Palestinians. It was founded in 1987. You know, it grew leaps and bounds. They were honest, you know, highly regarded, highly respected organization. And Muslims in the United States knew that when it was time to give
charity to give zakah, what they say in Arabic, how they say in Arabic, which is one of the, you know, one of the fundamentals of Islam, that the Holy Land Foundation was going to deliver, and in an honest way. So it grew, and then right after 9/11, there was this atmosphere in the United States where something had to be done, organizations had to be shut down, assets had to be frozen, money had to be stopped, and the atmosphere was, well, let's round up the usual suspects. And they were, you know, at the top of the list of the usual suspects, because they were high profile, they worked hard, they were well known. And later on, it was discovered that as early as 1993, as a result of work, some very effective work by the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, and other pro-Israeli groups and individuals, the FBI started listening to their phones and began an investigation into their work. Of course, they found nothing, but they'd already started that. So anyway, 9/11 comes around, and then by December, 9/11 was September, by December of that year, George Bush, who was president, comes out and declares that the Holy Land Foundation was closed down by executive order because it was a major terrorist funding network. In other words, the federal government was able to shut down a major terrorist funding network. And of course, we know that terrorists can't function without funds.
And I should interrupt, Miko, and just clarify that the specific charge was providing material support to Hamas.
Yes, Hamas was declared a terrorist organization in the United States by Bill Clinton in 1995. And so any dealing with Hamas was illegal. But the problem was there was no proof that they had given money to Hamas. And so there was a civil case. You know, they took the government to court to unfreeze their assets and to say, look, this is a bunch of nonsense. There was an enormous, a huge body of evidence proving that they never gave a penny. Not only did they never give a payment to Hamas, but every penny was accounted for. From start to finish, every penny could be traced. The administrative record, which is the document or the evidence that the government has to provide to justify why it closed them down, was laughable. And I'm quoting the lawyers that sued on their behalf, that worked for them. It was laughable. It was nonsense. There were some newspaper articles, uncorroborated statements, unsigned documents, a few faxes that were faxed over from Israel. And there was a statement by, there was only one problem. There was only one thing that was problematic, and that was a statement by a gentleman who was the manager of their office in Jerusalem, a guy by the name of Mohammed Anati. And in that statement, so the government claimed, he says, yes, we did give some money to Hamas. Now, he was arrested by the Israelis earlier allegedly because of that. So the defense team called his lawyer in Israel, who's a very well-known, you know, civil rights lawyer, Leah Tzemel, and asked her about this. And she said, what are you talking about? I have every single statement he ever made. He never said that. In fact, he said the opposite. So she sent them the actual statement. They had it independently translated and verified and notarized that he said exactly the opposite. He said, we never gave any money to Hamas. We were not political. The judge, her name is Judge Kessler here in D.C., dismissed the case and struck the evidence from the record.
Wow.
Upon appeal, the appellate court said, well, maybe she should not have struck the evidence. However, this is not a normal case. This is a case of sensitive national security issues. They maintained they upheld the decision of the judge, and that was it. And then later on, a couple of years later, 2 years later, they suddenly realized that the government was preparing a criminal case against them. In the criminal case, they changed the story. The government changed the story. They saw that they couldn't prove, that they couldn't show that they gave money to Hamas, because they didn't. So they said, well, they didn't give money to Hamas. They gave money to local charity organizations called Zakat committees. These are charity committees, local charity committees all over Palestine that have been around for forever. And the United States works with them. They've been vetted by the CIA. They've been vetted by other international organizations. The UN works with them. The Red Cross, everybody works with them. These committees, the government said, are part of Hamas. And therefore, even though they think they gave the money to charity, they actually gave the money to Hamas. And to that end, they had all kinds of documents that, again, were uncorroborated, unverified, unsigned, that were brought in by or sent in by the government of Israel. And they had two Israeli secret or anonymous witnesses. One was an officer in Israeli military intelligence, and one was an officer in the Shabak, which is the Israeli secret police, who were experts on the subject and testified that this is true, this is the case, that the Zakat committees are all Hamas.
Before we get into the trial itself, and there were two trials, they were acquitted in the first one. I want to ask you about that. But before we get into that, let's talk about the five men themselves, because you got to know them pretty well. You visited them in prison. You met their families. Talk about what they were like, and then let's talk about the first trial.
To say that they're fine, honest men is an understatement. These are the finest, most honest men you will ever meet. They're not only finest, honest men, but these are the finest, honest men who decided to dedicate their lives to help others. They all suffered directly from the Palestinian, not conflict, but the Palestinian tragedy, the Palestinian catastrophe, you know, the destruction of Palestine when Israel was established in 1948, and then they all suffered directly from what happened in 1967 when Israel expanded its borders to include the West Bank and Gaza. They were made refugees. Their families suffered. You know, and I talk, there's about a chapter about each one of them and their story and how they were connected and related and so on.
Wonderful book, Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. And we were talking about these men, and now we're going to be speaking about the first trial, and then they were brought again to a second trial where they were convicted for long terms. But let's talk about the first trial. Can you tell us about the hung jury?
So the first trial was very bizarre. The defense team had really torn apart the government's case. They tore to shreds. Even the anonymous witnesses, who they could not question their identity or their education or their qualifications or anything about them, because everything, we still don't even know their names. Their theory was torn apart. They showed how the Zakat committees were not listed, were not affiliated with Hamas, none of their board members. Nobody could show that anything the Zakat committees ever did was connected to Hamas, or that there was any evidence to show that they were connected to Hamas. And they had the former U.S. consul general in Jerusalem, and they had, you know, I mean, they showed clearly that this was nonsense. They tore them apart. At the end of the trial, something very bizarre happened. There were no acquittals, but there were no convictions. It was a hung jury. Except on one, Mufid Abdul Qadir, which really should not have been part of the trial at all. He was a volunteer. He never had anything to do with the workings of the organization. He would come and sing. He would come and perform skits. He would do fundraising for them. And he was found not guilty on all 32 charges. The judge actually said not guilty 32 times. Then, when the jury was polled, one of the jurors suddenly stood up and said, no, I made a mistake. I didn't mean that. So immediately the judge declared a mistrial on him as well. Now, the only reason he's even part of this, in my opinion, is because his brother happens to be Khaled Mash'al, who was the head of the political bureau of Hamas for many, many years. He's the political face of Hamas. That's really the only reason he is there. And also, he and two of the others are all from the same village, the same town in Palestine, from Sidi Waad. So they threw them in there for us to make a stronger connection, I think. So that was it. It was a mistrial, and everybody for Mufid it was a disaster because he was really supposed to be set free. And then about a year later, the government came back. They adjusted the accusations. They changed the way they approached. They changed their approach. They didn't charge everybody. They changed the indictment, so not everybody was charged with the exact same thing. It was, you know, so they figured out what they can get away with and how they can get a conviction. The second judge had allowed documents and witnesses and evidence the first judge did not permit, and this was evidence. And the first judge was very lenient with the prosecution, but this was evidence that should never have been allowed in a court of law. It's completely irrelevant. And then they came out with a second trial with convictions. All convictions. Two of them got 65 years. Mufid got 20 years, who was supposed to walk away. And then two others got 15 years each.
Because Heidi and I sat through a lot of the Lynn Stewart trial. And the evidence that they brought in to prejudice the jury was the same kind of stuff that they did to the Holy Land Five, for example, trying to link them up with Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. The whole practice of Islamophobia was set to work.
We have about 10 minutes left, and we want to talk about some other aspects. Notably, what difference do you think it made to these men in terms of how they were treated in prison because they were Muslim?
Well, that's another very interesting part of the story. In terms of the authorities, they were Muslim terrorists, and that's how they are treated. So they are treated very poorly. At every opportunity, they were called terrorists. They spent more time in solitary confinement than, you know, than anybody who's guilty of severe crimes should ever have to, let alone somebody who's innocent. I mean, months and months and months and months in solitary. There was clearly an effort to deny their right to worship and pray, even though they, in an admirable and creative ways, found ways to maintain their faith and to observe their faith. And again, I describe all of this in the book. I mean, there's some scenes there that just you know, I've written and I've read this text a million times, and it still brings tears to my eyes. I mean, it's beyond belief. However, their identity as Muslims among the prisoners is a very positive thing, because, and this is what I learned from them, within the prison, among the prisoners, as a group that stands out, Muslims are highly respected. And in the prison, you have to belong to somebody. You have to belong to something. You have to have protection. So the Muslims take care of each other, and the Muslims are highly respected. And these guys are not only Muslims. They're Arabs. They speak. They're religious. They know the Quran. In other words, these are, you know, they're highly educated people. They're respectable. They're, you know what I mean? So in that regard, Islam was really, is from what I hear from them, was an asset. And also in terms of keeping them sane. When you read what they had to go through and what they have to go through every single day, I know for sure I would have lost my mind, you know, days into it, not years into it, but days into it. The thing that maintained their sanity is the strength of their spiritual foundation. It is something the likes of which I've never seen, and that's Islam.
And Miko, it's evident in your book that you came to understand, respect, and admire the Muslim faith. Can you briefly talk about that?
Well, you know, I grew up in Jerusalem, so for me, I always had a warm spot in my heart for Islam, because when you walk around Jerusalem, particularly the Old City, you know, Islam is everywhere, and it's very beautiful, and you see this, you see the generosity, you see the beauty, you see the aesthetics, you see the warmth that Islam, that is an integral part of Islam. Having met them and gotten to know them well, you know, and learned a little bit more about Islam as a result of that, I feel that my initial sentiment towards Islam was certainly not only justified, but, you know, but strengthened. It's all about this sense of, you know, greeting people with wishes for, you know, peace and good things. You know, salam alaikum, and go with peace and come with peace, and the sense of you know, generosity and openness. And again, I have an entire chapter about Islam, and I have an entire chapter about the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, and, you know, trying to dispel some of the misconceptions and some of the negative characteristics that have been spread here in America about this, about Islam as a religion, about the Muslim Brotherhood, and so forth. So I spent a lot of time doing that, and I think, you know, it's important because this case cannot be seen out of context. You have to see it within the context of Islam. We have to see it within the context of the occupation of Palestine and the ethnic cleansing and the genocide that takes place in Palestine. We have to see it in the context of U.S.-Israel relations. And then we have to see it in the context of the personal story of each and every one. And I tried to show each and every one of these aspects and deal with each and one of these aspects so that the reader has the context to understand the case.
You use the word genocide. And I agree with you, because genocide doesn't necessarily mean the physical extermination of a people. But why do you use the word genocide with respect to Palestinians?
Well, I think if we, it's an excellent question. I think if we look at the Geneva Convention definition of the crime of genocide, which is easy to find, and we place it next to what happened in Palestine, description of what Israel has done since 1948, or the creation of Israel has done to Palestinians, and what has happened over the last seven decades, there's no doubt that it's genocide. It falls under the definition of the crime of genocide. The destruction of a people, the erasure of a culture, and the destruction of a country, the destruction of a nation, the attempt to kill and destroy, and not just the people, but their culture, their history, their land, changing names, destroying landscapes and destroying monuments. You know, it reads like textbook genocide. So there is a genocide going on. There can be no doubt if you look at, again, the Geneva Convention, the definition. And there's also an ethnic cleansing campaign that's happening. And there's also a regime of apartheid, which is how Israel is run, is governed. It's governed by an apartheid regime.
Miko, we'd like to conclude by asking you if you'd please read a section of your book for the audience. Might you start with the paragraph that starts, Ghassan explained the strength that the Quran has for him.
Ghassan explained the strength that the Quran has for him and the strength it has given him. The Quran is full of verses that were revealed in order to bring comfort and hope to the Prophet Muhammad and his companions during their time of hardship. Among these stories is that of Moses and his trials in leading the children of Israel out of slavery in Egypt, and the story of David facing Goliath and his ultimate victory, all of which press upon the believers that with the help of God Almighty, justice will prevail. These were stories that were familiar to me as well from the Jewish tradition. It struck me that as Israelis, we like to see ourselves as the descendants of Moses and David. It is all too clear that today we are more like the Pharaoh and Goliath. As Ghassan said to me, what my friends and I did at the Holy Land Foundation was to help Palestinians who are suffering. They are victims because they find themselves living under a brutal, racist regime that practices apartheid. To be persecuted for such noble work is exactly what the prophets had faced at their time. And being reminded of this is how I get through it. Indeed, their faith has made them unenslavable.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I've read your book, The General's Son, and I've read your new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, and it really resonates with me, growing up Jewish, having visited Israel in 1959, and having followed what's gone on there and been active in the Palestine solidarity work since the 60s. But I wanted to just comment that listeners should know that your father was a general in the Israeli army in 1967, and then he really had second thoughts about what the Israelis accomplished in defeating the Arabs and grabbing their land, and wanted to work out a settlement with the Palestinians where they would withdraw and not be military occupiers. And your understanding of that phenomena, and then the story you tell about your niece, your sister's daughter, who was killed by a terrorist bombing, one would expect that you in every way would be on the side of the Israeli hardliners, but you're not. And I wanted to ask you, could you just very briefly talk about what you think people who sympathize with the Palestinians should be doing?
I think that the single most important thing anybody who believes in justice, in freedom, needs to do is to support wholeheartedly and without reserve the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, the call for BDS. Any other, solidarity without, unless it's attached to this kind of action, and particularly the call for BDS, which sets very clear demands and has provided for all of us who are on the outside a very clear path with which to help the Palestinians. It was a call that came from Palestinians to the rest of the world saying, here is how you can help. It's dedicated, it's principled, it's, I believe, undefeatable. It's gained a great deal of success already, even though it's facing enormous opposition. But I believe that anybody who cares for justice in Palestine, anybody who believes that Palestinians and all people deserve to be free and live in a just world must support and do more than support, act according to the call of BDS, the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel.
Miko Peled, thank you very much. You're the author of this tremendously important book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko Pellad, thank you for being on Law and Disorder, and I wish you every success.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, Miko.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.